Hello, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 8 of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. I'm Becca, and this is a podcast that features members of the Virtual Coffee community. Virtual Coffee is an intimate group of developers at all stages of their coding journey, and they're here on this podcast sharing their stories and what they've learned. And we're here to share it with you. Here with me today is my co-host, Stan.
Hello, Becca.
Hey,
today we had a really really fun episode. We sat down with Matt McInnes. He is a data scientist, a full stack engineer, a founder. Used to be a math professor. He has a very interesting journey and a very interesting career. So it was very cool to hear his. Can I just say very a couple more times? I'm excited though. It was a fun time to sit down with Matt. I don't know. He's had a cool career and so many different things he's like gotten into. And he's built a lot of different things and it was a fun conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his journey is super interesting, going from math professor to working at some really big tech places and talking about how he got those jobs by building things that were useful to him. I felt like was super inspiring to anybody who's trying to break into tech, but just to see how he developed his career and followed his interests is really, inspiring, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it hit home for me a lot. It's one of those things that I never did consciously, and I don't think Matt did really either. He would build things that would help him, you know, help himself. So he talked about he built something that was like helping to buy tickets or sell tickets. And yeah. It wasn't like a scheme to make money or a scheme to get a job, you know, it was just a thing that helped him his own like life. You know, he wasn't trying to sell the product or, do any of the things that you hear about these days a lot. He just was like interested and built something. And then some people heard about it. You'll hear about the rest, but, it was cool. Yeah. It hit home for me. That's building projects is like, that's always my advice to people too, is just build things that you're either interested in or could help yourself. And the rest will come sort of naturally. So it was cool. I had a good time talking to him.
Yeah. It was a fascinating episode. And we hope that you enjoy it, and we're going to start it the same way that we start every virtual coffee, with our names, where we're from, what we do, and our random check-in question. So enjoy. Today's random check-in question is, if you could appear on any game show, what would it be? I'm Becca. I am a technical community builder from a small town in Ohio. And game show, I don't know. If there was a Sudoku game show, I would like to try that. I don't think that's a thing. So I guess I'll go on Wheel of Fortune. I don't know, Price is Right. I feel like as an adult, I've gotten better at that. Like, oh, I know the price of that. But I don't know. I think I'll stick with Wheel of Fortune.
Wheel of Fortune always seemed like a fun time, you know?
It doesn't seem so stressful.
I feel like a Sudoku game show would be pretty boring to watch. Might be fun to compete in, but...
Maybe some kind of obstacles they throw in, right? Like, ooh. Once you... fill in one row, then something happens. You get slimed.
Slimed.
Did you ever watch Double Dare?
Oh, man. Okay, so hi, I'm Dan. I do front end development mostly in Cleveland. And game show. American Gladiators is the first thing that popped into my head.
That's what I'm doing.
I've always wanted to do, especially the thing I feel like that ended with it, but the one where you run around shooting the Nerf guns at the, you know, and the gladiator person is up on top shooting Nerf gun stuff at you or tennis balls. I don't really know. I haven't watched it obviously in a long time, but
American Ninja Warrior too. I forgot.
American Ninja Warrior is cool. That seems a lot harder though, but it would be cool to try. I would definitely try that.
But would you be a contestant or one of the gladiators if you're on the show?
I have to start. I'd have to start as a contestant, you know. Yeah, I'm not going to just like swoop in and, you know, I got to earn my way up, right? I feel like plus I'd get the. Well, did the contestants have the what do you call them? Like a not a jumpsuit, but the what do you call those things that they wore? Or like that wrestlers wore?
I think it's jumps.
No, there's a name for it, isn't it? What's the thing? What's the thing that like wrestlers wear?
Singlet?
Singlet maybe? I don't know.
I think that's another word for it. But it's not leotards, is it?
No. I mean, it's basically a leotard, but it's like...
It's just singlet. Singlet is what you wear in wrestling.
I don't know. That doesn't sound right, but you're probably right. We'll ask Nick after the pie.
Yeah. It's great to be here, guys. Thank you for having me. I'm Matt. I'm a developer from Toronto, Canada. I run a small company called Typist, where we make educational software. And if I was on one game show, my first, American Gladiator wins, but my first reaction was Kid Street. It's this old game show. I don't know if I was 12 years old again, I think and everyone kind of clapped over their head. Like there was this like thing that they did if they got a question right. And if you won, it was like every kid's dream. You got to go into like this middle platform that was like stocked like a toy store. And you had like 2 minutes to just grab whatever you wanted. It was like, yeah. So my sisters and I, we would watch Kid Street and we'd be like, how do we get on this TV show? And we never quite cracked the egg on that one. It was a very disappointing childhood, I guess you could say. Yeah. No, I'm kidding, but it's Kid Street, but I can also second Dan's answer because that sounds awesome.
Wow. I have never seen Kid Street before.
Yeah, there's this funny kind of from Canada, there's this funny Canadian subculture around some things. Like there are these really kind of weird things that pop up every now and then that are extremely popular, like household, everybody knows them, even like music and bands sometimes. They were fueled by this entertainment industry that like out of Toronto, but like these companies called Much Music and their related subsidiaries, but are just totally unknown in the US. Which is funny because the US is a 2-hour drive from where I'm living. Like it's close, right? Like we're right there. We go to Buffalo Bills games all the time. It's across this, feels like it's across the street, but you go down there and you're like, oh, they're Tragically Hip. And it's like, half of Canada's all-time favorite band and people in the US are like, who? Like, who's that? there's these things. So Kid Street might be one of them too. And, all these like kind of old TV shows for kids, especially.
Yeah, I need to check it out. I like pulled up it is a Canadian children's game show.
So. It is Canadian, eh? Oh, you guys missed out. This was epic. Like, and it would have been way better if the US had done it. The mall would have been cooler. Like it just would have been like the production quality would have been way up there. Like where's Nickelodeon at when for Kid Street?
I love it. It looks very 80s. I need to check this out.
Yeah, it was cool.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us today, Matt. We always like to get started with your origin story. So if you could give us what the story is that brought you here to today where you are in tech.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for having me, Dan and Becca. Starting focusing on the tech side of things, I graduated. I did degrees in math. I love math. I think it's still my Twitter handle. I decided that like the change I wanted to make in the world after graduating was I wanted to improve the way that people learn mathematics at the post-secondary level. The programs that I took were massacres. We had such few people finish relative to how many started. And I worked all the way through university in math help centers and as a TA. And I saw people in non-math disciplines kind of drop out of their like early childhood education program because they couldn't complete their stats course. And I thought that was crazy because if it's taught properly, I don't think math is hard, with that strong caveat, if it's taught properly. And so I really wanted to kind of affect change there. I took a job. I applied everywhere for these. In Canada, we call them math professorships at community colleges in Canada. In the US, it's probably known as a math instructor in the community college system. And so I took a job in Saskatchewan. I moved from the small town of Aurora, Ontario, where I grew up to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, which is 40,000 person town, like in the, it was really awesome. I loved it out there. And I had some family there too. And that's where, I guess my journey to tech started. I was a math person. I really had no experience with tech at that point. I was, 24. And I just started wanting to make things. I remember the first thing I wanted to make was I had read a book that's now very popular, Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point. And he described like Sesame Street in the 80s and how they would like engineer this TV show. They would bring kids in and they would put Sesame Street on one screen and this thing called the distractor on the other screen. And every 7 seconds, this distractor would display these still images that would switch. So every 7 seconds, a different image. And you'd put like 20 kids in the room, and the researchers would just look at their eyes and be like, are they looking at the distractor? Are they looking at Sesame Street? And then they would go back and they'd graph it after they'd done like a couple cycles of kids, and they'd see what are the parts of the TV show that kids were disengaged with that we need to re-engineer. And that was like the first, and I was like, man, if they could do that in the 80s, why can't, like, in, you know, this was, I guess, like 2010. I'm like, why can't we do that like in real time, live while I'm teaching in class? And that was my first project, was I wanted to build something that did that. And I had learned that Hasbro had put out this toy called the Star Wars Force Trainer. It's a ridiculous toy. But you'd have like a headset that you'd put on. And it turns out this thing could actually take a low-level EEG reading of brain activity, if your brain was active or not. And then like the toy would connect wirelessly to this base unit that had a fan that would spin a ball up and down in this toy. And so hence the force trainer is you concentrate really hard and you can use the force to move this ball up and down. Like, really cool toy, right? And I said, well, if I could just get the electrical signal out of that and into my computer and graph it, that would be the whole thing. And that was my first foray into tech. I was like, how do I get the electrical signal out? And how does electricity work? And how does circuits work? And I learned about microprocessors, and the Arduino had like just come out at the time. And so I started like getting these, like, I found that kids' books for Arduino were actually way better than the ones they were making for adults. So I got all these like kids' books and started like doing these experiments. And then I needed, you know, these wires soldered. So I'd go down to the electrical department and be like, hey guy, I was teaching like math for electricians as part of my job there. Like, hey, can you do some soldering for me? And like put these, and it, you know, at this point it had like kind of become this like project, and I got it working. After, you know, on the code side, I learned that there was this language called processing, which was Java based, that could do the graphing pretty easily for me if I could just pull the signal in. And I got that working. And then I, you know, like 6 months later, presented it at a conference down in Saskatoon, one of the cities in Saskatchewan. And at that point I was hooked. And, you know, from there, I really wanted to continue making things that would make me a better teacher. And that drove me for a long time. And then, you know, a couple of years after that, I started doing that reflection of what do I want in terms of a career and a lifestyle, and like, what are the things I'm after? And that really kind of led me to getting interested in, you know, code as a career. There weren't really, you know, boot camps, and Coursera, I don't even think had been really created at that point or launched, or, you know, the whole suite of the edX, Udemy, Coursera, awesome websites for these things, right? So it was a lot of learning. I did that all while I had a full-time job. And, you know, fast forward a number of years, I launched Typus, the company I now run, my little small passion project, I sometimes call it. At the same time, AI exploded. And this was maybe six, 7 years ago now. And AI, if nothing else, is a combination of computer science and like a really strong math background. And, you know, back then, more emphasis on the math, but today, maybe more emphasis on the computer science side. And so IBM came knocking and said, hey, we are trying to hire AI expertise. And at that point, I had some projects that, like, I was experimenting a lot in AI. And so they offered me a dream job to go in and be on this new open source team that they're putting across Canada. And I'd get to work with all these huge companies and help them do AI better and solve these problems. And that sounded like a blast. So I did that for a number of years. And then later I moved over to Microsoft to do a similar type work, like more hands. I wanted to get deeper into projects, and Microsoft gave me that opportunity to go deeper into data science projects with companies, and all for free. These companies would just parachute me in, or IBM would just, Microsoft would just parachute me in. And it's like, yeah, we're going to help you do data science better, because if you do it on our cloud, we're going to make a lot of money. So I'd get to go and just like pick my projects and go on site. I'd get like a badge. It was awesome. And, you know, and build out these data science projects, and all the while on my evenings and weekends building out Typist, trying to get it to the place where it could support, you know, a basic income for me, and I could work on it full time, which eventually happened. And you know, that sort of switchover process was scary and, you know, different than I had imagined it would be. But eventually my boss at Microsoft was like, Matt, you got to go do this. It's there, like, go do this thing. And I did. And that's what I've been working on for the last 3 or 4 years.
That's amazing. I have to ask about that switch, because I feel like that sounds like very scary. giving up all of the stuff that you've been doing with a team, with all of these resources, and then just jumping into this entrepreneur journey. I know that you said that you had some encouragement, but like, what really pushed you to go all in on Typist?
You know, it was really, really hard. You know, I guess like one of the big factors was I thought that we had a project lined up for Typist, and Typist, maybe this is the appropriate time to kind of speak to what it is. We make software for community college students who are taking a certain set of courses. So our first product was for community college students who are taking keyboarding courses. And those are people studying programs to be law clerks or legal assistants, medical assistants, or even executive assistants. And very, you know, there's interesting demographics in those programs, which is a reason I'm really passionate to work on and honored to build software for that group. And then we have this second product, which at that point, Becca, was really, we had scoped it out. And it was in this thing called document production. So, you know, people that go in these fields need to be able to make a professionally formatted business letter that has these exact traits. And it's like sort of a vocational skill. And in that particular field, it's rated as like a top three employment skill too, by all, every industry survey that's ever been done. And it's really, really hard to teach. And we had I've been like kind of kicking the tires with the people who are using our keyboarding software to be like, hey, does anyone want to partner to build this with us? And by partner, just like give us feedback, tell us what to build, like whiteboard. And ideally, if we build you something you really like, be the, you know, the person to use it and give us the reference so that we can maybe expand this. And that was a big part of the decision, was I had all that lined up. And so for the 6 to 7 months prior to that, and this was the final push, I had outsourced the development of it to a really great developer, who like great, you know, really, really talented Rails developer. We had a prototype and we went back to this college and presented this, and I'd take vacation days anytime I had to go take meetings. Right. So all of my vacation for those like 4 years was consumed by Typist. So I'd take a vacation day, I'd go and we'd present this back to the group, and they had said, yes, if you can build it and it can do these things, but we need these changes, it, you know, we'll use it. But at that point, I looked at like how we had constructed the software, and I said, it's not going to get us to the finish line. We were, you know, specifically, we had built it in Rails, and it all works with file IO. So there, you need to upload this file, and then we would go compare it to this other file. They're both Word documents, which are incredibly hard to work with. Mm-hmm. And we, like, you know, the way all the existing previous software, like if there's a typo in a paragraph, you lost all the marks of the paragraph because doing fuzzy matching is like really, really hard. I sat there and I'm like, we can't do this in our web server. It takes like 20 seconds to process a single file. We'll be in classes. They'll do a test. They'll get 30 uploads at once. We'll never be able to handle the spike in traffic. We'll never be able to, we don't want a web server sitting idle for, and I just, long story short, knew we had to rebuild the software completely from scratch. And we had 5 months to do it. We had gone in and already produced, like we had already done the demo and been like, yeah, it's working, look. And I knew that we had to throw away everything that we'd done and build it from scratch, and which we did. So that was like, there was an immediacy, which helped, I guess, make that decision of like, so when I went in and had that conversation with my wonderful, wonderful boss, Özge, and I was explaining this all to her, she's like, I'm like, Özge, if we're going to launch this thing and this could push Typist over the mark of like it could support a couple employees, I've got to go now. Like I can't wait till next week. I've got to start right now. And she's like, yep, do it. And at that point, I like almost on the spot gave my notice. I talked to my wife, and that was the jump. And it was a hard summer, by the way. Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty intense. Obviously I don't. But it seems like it worked out, right? I mean, kind of betting on yourself. And I mean, maybe it wasn't much of a bet. Did you have a good idea of, so you said you had to, you know, tear it down and rebuild it. Did you have a good idea at that like moment of like what it was going to look like when you were finished rebuilding it? Or were you just like, we have like, are starting from scratch and have no idea, you know?
Yeah, we knew that, and I did. And maybe you know, and I'm happy to speak to kind of the details of it because I think they're interesting if that's,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
So like we, you know, I mentioned we couldn't do this on web servers because like, you know, the really simple use case was that if 20 students are doing a test and they all upload their documents at once and they take 25 seconds to process, web servers just can't do that. We would have to have like this incredible scale that would just be so expensive we couldn't run the business. And so the my theory was that we needed a couple things. We needed to not be using Ruby because like a node-based system made a lot more sense in the way that a node event loop works, you know. And the second thing was we needed a way to deploy these sort of algorithms that we were building in a way that could handle these spikes in traffic. And at that point, sort of this Lambda architecture, which is, you know, all the clouds have a product for this. So in Microsoft, it's called Azure Functions, and AWS is called Lambda. In, you know, Netlify just launched one, I think, actually, and Cloudflare has one called Cloudflare Functions too. But they basically work that like something happens and they spin up your code and they do the thing you want it to do, and then they spin down and you can throw 1,000 at them. And they, you know, 1,000 instances will spin up, you'll pay for the time they're up, and then they'll turn off when they're done. And so that was kind of what I knew, was that we had to rewrite this into that this Lambda type architecture that could handle these spikes. We had to switch languages. So we had to use a language that was compatible there and well supported, and Ruby wasn't supported at all. So that had to go to JavaScript. And then there was, you know, to your question, Dan, there were questions that I was really, really concerned about, which were, how are we going to go in and like that problem on evaluation? So if you're a student, you upload this document and you're off by like two characters, we couldn't take off all the marks, right? So we had to be able to go in and compare the text we expected students to type and the text that they did type and take off some like type of marks that was proportional to that and give meaningful feedback on the other side. And at that point, I had no idea how we were going to solve that problem. Which we, you know, later figured out a way to. And even just converting, like, how do we even, so, you know, just as a quick comment, docx files are really hard to work with, but here's like a fun thing you can do. If you're on a Windows machine, take a docx file on your desktop, rename it to .zip, and then extract it, and you'll see the general how these files are structured. And inside there is all this kind of markup that will be a little bit familiar to you if you've seen XML or HTML before. And you can see all the stuff in there. So we knew that we had to like deal with that problem too, which we didn't know how we were going to handle because we were using these Ruby libraries that kind of abstracted that away for us.
Yeah, so you made this career journey, I guess. So from math, and then you were doing AI, data science stuff, and then Rails backend stuff, and now JavaScript and React, right?
Yeah. And you know, I think the first part of that would be like, it's worth expanding on. Like it was, like when I started learning code, data science is generally done in Python and R. Like those are the language for data science, and heavy emphasis on Python these days. Like academics use R, but nobody else really does. I really didn't know a ton of Python, but it's such an approachable language. That 7 years of learning code, like, you know, I breezed past it in a sentence, but that was really hard. It was a lot of evenings and weekends. I was working full time that whole time. I at some points had like even taken on contract gigs doing statistical consulting for some stuff. And it was web dev that I was learning during that time, Becca. It was, I had started I had started with HTML and CSS and had like learned that and built a personal website. And then it was like, you know, these projects all the way through. Like I wanted, at the time people were downloading TV shows and movies and stuff, maybe, you know, in a way they shouldn't. But it was like really hard. So like I wanted to go, if I download the new season of The Office, I wanted to search The Office and have it organized like episode 1, episode 2, episode 3, and then get rid of the ones that were like somebody holding their camera and do all this. So I built a website to do that. And it was like so basic. It was a single PHP file that just went and like kind of scraped the Pirate Bay and then analyzed the file names. And then I had no idea how to use databases. So it would just stick the results into like a text file on like GoDaddy. So it was like, that's where I was starting from. And there's so many other, like another one that was fun was when I was teaching at the college, you'd put all your marks into like an Excel doc. So I was like, okay, well, I want like to give my students more contextual feedback on how they're doing in the course. So I put it into a Google Doc and I was like, how do I get this thing to send email? And that was like one of the first things I'd written in JavaScript, was to like go take all my students. And if they're like, if they've not done well in the first two quizzes, send them an email that's like, hey, you know, John, I saw you didn't do very well in the first two quizzes. Here are my office hours. There's also the Math Help Center if you need support. I'm here for you. Like, you know, like really want to help you turn this around. And if they were doing really well, they'd get like a more positive note with different content. And there, I had like six different templates and I just hit go and everybody would get an email from me in like my five sections or whatever.
I need that 10 years ago. That would save me so much time. Wow, that's amazing.
It was great. And then, like, the part I felt guilty about back there was I'd get these responses. Be like, wow, thank you for taking the time to write me this email.
Is that not a product for teachers? Because if it's not, it should be.
Well, it's just like, that's like a CRM, right? A CRM except for students is like, you have all the automated mail campaigns and stuff, you know, except you're emailing.
Okay, I need to Google this after we're done, because if it is a thing, I need to tell everybody that I know that's still a teacher about it. Yeah. If not, then that's my new project.
Yeah, it's, you know, so that was like, there were these projects on the way, right? And they were all usually connected to something I wanted to see in the world. Another really big one I took on that was like less code, but it was, you know, it was my first experience with Rails was, you know, I was teaching at the college and I was helping to volunteer coach this marketing team, which I don't know what I was doing there. I was like the math guy, right? But I wanted to get my students more experience doing actual, like the part of marketing that really is interesting to me is the analytics of it. There's really rich analytics and the math is just super fun to look at. But there is like, and Google Analytics was out there at the time, but it was really hard to get experience with actual data. So I thought, well, what if we could get like a website up that would, you know, have a bunch of data that students could just mess around with and we could like do stuff. We could go put posters up and drive traffic. And then I was also really interested and still am in volunteerism. And I said, you know, I've had these great, wonderful, like life-changing experience volunteering. Like, you know, what if we could drive more volunteers to charities? You know, I was also really attracted to short video format. So I sort of took the summer off and I emailed the sort of CEOs of charities in Toronto and said, hey, I went on, you know, Facebook and Craigslist trying to find a videographer who would volunteer with me. And I did. And we went, and my pitch was like, hey, we're going to take your CEO. We're going to go on site where volunteerism is happening. We're going to shoot like a 45-second to 1-minute video of you telling volunteers why it would be so great to volunteer with your organization. And we did that. We did like five of the biggest charities in Toronto. And then we put them on a website that I called Where the Good Is. And then we took the marketing students, we promoted it around the college. And then like we had Google Analytics installed. So they would like drive the traffic to the website and we got to analyze it all. And it was really fun. And that was like my first website in Rails. It was a static web page with just a bunch of videos, but it was a great way to learn. And there's probably like a million other projects that are, you know, similar. That's what I was learning the 7 years was. I was really getting into web development. I loved it. I loved making things. And the more relevant they were for me, the better. And you know, my last one, which was like a full Rails app, that was just a static page, right? Was this, I wanted a Chrome extension. So my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, we could just hit a button in Chrome and we could share the web page that we're looking at with like a little note. And it would just like jump to the other person's browser. And so I built a little app that did that. And that was like the first, you know, full, like real meaningful, like a web app, you know, like that did stuff on the back end and used a database. And you know, during that time, also courses started coming out. So I took a wonderful database course from Stanford, and then the University of Washington has amazing courses, and that allowed me to kind of get to the bottom of how these things worked, which I was incredibly curious about. Like the hardware software interface course from the University of Washington is just straight up one of the best courses I've ever taken. Like it's like how it, like it tackles the problem of like how does the code you type in Python change things in a computer, and how does a computer work at all? And that was like the missing gap that I needed to kind of address. And that was a wonderful experience. And yeah, that's what like that 7 years was like. And then towards the end of it, the project that I made that kind of got the attention of IBM was I had like had this am I rambling here? I feel like I'm talking.
No, this is great.
No.
I have a big baseball fan. I've got my little Blue Jays hat in the background on the, you know, here behind me. And we love going to the home opener, which is the first baseball game of the year. And I had gone and we buy tickets, but they're always sell out. So you have to buy resale, and resale is like three times the price. And we paid that one year, we paid like $110, which was outrageous at the time, to sit in like $20 seats at like the top of the stadium. And I was so upset by this. You know, I was really, and then, you know, one of my friends couldn't come. So I had to like, I tried to scalp the ticket. So I was like outside the stadium instead of like, and I like had, you know, a couple of bottles of juice to give myself the courage to do it. And so I was standing outside the stadium with my best scalper booker to see like, tickets? Who needs tickets? And I remember there's this, I'd like, of all, there's 50,000 people there. Of course, like a friend walks by and he's like, what in the hell are you doing? And what in the heck are you doing? And then I'll never forget this mom and her daughter. The daughter must have been like 17, 18 years old, right? And they're walking by and I'm out there, just tickets, I need a ticket. And she so politely says, no, thank you. Everyone just ignores you. She's like, no, thank you. And she looks at me and then looks down at my shirt, and I've got my university Western shirt on. And she gives me, like, her face just drops, and she looks at her daughter, who's like also got a Western shirt on, and just has this like sad look of horror as they walk into the stadium. Like, this is what my daughter's gonna be. But anyways, that whole experience was really upsetting. And so I'm like, well, you know, I learned that if you bought season tickets for like all 90 games in a season, then you would get like a 15% discount, and then I could get the $20 ticket. And so, of course, you know, what's a reasonable thing to do? Spend $9,000 on season tickets. Yeah, so I basically took 2/3 of my savings in my bank account and I funded the money on season tickets. But my theory was I could sell them at face value to my friends. And since I got this like 15% discount, that would more than make up for the gap. And Pam and I could go to like 3 or 4 games for free, which is all I really wanted. And but to do that, I needed to figure out how to price all these tickets. And so I wrote a Electron desktop app that went and scraped all the data from BlueJays.com and scraped all the data from StubHub, and wrote an algorithm to, like, you know, if you scrape StubHub one day and you scrape it the next day, you can figure out what tickets are not there anymore, and then you can figure out what sold and for what price. Whoa. Since you do all the things. And so I built a really nice clean data set, and then I trained an algorithm to price my tickets. And you know, again, I have this Electron app, and I just click a button, it would price all my tickets, send an email to my friends, and then people just earmarked what tickets I want. And it worked. And I did that for, you know, I've been doing that for 4 or 5 years now, or 6 years, I guess. There's like a 2-year gap that I, you know, decided not to renew because of COVID. And then that got the attention of IBM, being like, hey, that's a really awesome project. And that's what kind of opened that door. But, you know,
When I was leaving education to come into tech, I made money. I remember the most money I made, I bought and resold Justin Bieber tickets on StubHub. And it was a lot of research. That would have been something that would have been very useful to me during that time. Wow, oh, yeah. That's amazing. Justin Bieber also made me a lot of money, so I don't hate Justin Bieber. He's great.
Yeah, he's Canadian. Yeah, he's from down the road there.
That's right.
Yeah, we have a lot of mixed feelings about Justin Bieber, but they're generally positive. He's doing his best. I'm glad he did well by you, Becca. That's good.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know what to say other than that's amazing. Yeah. And what I did want to say was, we have a lot of people who are listening to the podcast who are coming into tech, and I really love all of these stories that you're telling, because all of the things that you made were useful to you and they made sense for you to make. And so there's always that question of like, well, what am I supposed to be doing? What am I supposed to be building? And you don't have to build an Electron app that analyzes what to price your Blue Jays tickets at, but like find that thing that's meaningful and then go for that and see where that takes you and who notices you based on that.
Totally. And, you know, I have a friend, I've had these experiences where while I was at the college back in Dan, I connected with this group called Hacker Paradise that facilitates these remote sort of work experiences. And, you know, it turns out that was really impactful for me. And there's a woman I met there who's amazing. Her name's Nicole Keller. And she has had this really, really cool career path. But one of the things she was doing down in New York was running coding classes for kids. And the thing that I I got to visit. Pam and I had gone to New York, and called up Nicole and been like, "Hey," and she's like, "Oh yeah, I'm working. I'm doing this coding class weekend." I'm like, "Can we come see? Like, that sounds awesome." And we went in, and it was like the attic of this church, like in like mainland, New York. And we is that what it's called? Mainland New York, New York Island. What's it? What do you guys call it? Manhattan.
Manhattan. Yes.
Yeah, Manhattan. And we. and it was, but like the thing I loved, Becca, was that they started the kids who were like, they were just building static sites. They'd use like a website builder. They were like as young as like 8, 9 years old, but they started them with, they had gone to the UN's, and I forget what it's called, but like, basically these are like our principles. And they had asked the kids, like, what's one thing that you'd want to affect change with? And let's build a website to do that. Like they didn't start with teaching JavaScript or teaching HTML or CSS. They started with like, what's the change you want to see in the world? Mm-hmm. And how can we use these amazing tools to do this? And I think that for people who are getting into tech, there's a lot of people that are coming in for many, many reasons into tech. And especially now, it's like, I think people are realizing that you can have this great lifestyle with it, which is wonderful. And that's a great reason to come into tech. There's these other things that are connected to it. I think one thing I'd love to introduce to that sort of, thought process is that this is a tremendously powerful thing. You can make computers do stuff automatically, and that's awesome. And it can really affect positive change in the world. And so, as you're figuring out what your learning projects are, think about what you'd want to change about the world. Like, can you make something for your friend group? Can you make something for yourself? Can you automate something that you're doing regularly? Can you make something that would be just really funny or cool? What do you want to make? And I think if you start with that, that can be really powerful, because if you're self-taught, one of the biggest challenges you're going to face, and one of the biggest challenges I faced, is how do you do it regularly? There would be weeks I, couldn't bring myself to have the energy to code at like 9 o'clock at night, right? And to continue that learning. Learning is so hard, and it's such an emotionally challenging journey too. But if you're connected to something that you just want to see out there, that's a deeper level of motivation than some of the other ones that can be out there. I think that's powerful.
Yeah. I love that a lot. And this is, we just released Roger's episode. We talked to him a couple weeks ago, and he said a lot of the same things, and he has sort of not the exact path, but like self-taught, and solving his own problems sort of thing to learn, coding. And so I was, on the same boat too. I think my first website, well, that wasn't like a GeoCity site, was like a site for my band, right? It was like in Flash or whatever.
That's awesome.
It's fine. But we nowadays, there's so many learning like opportunities out of the boot camps and everything like that. And there's so many different choices to make, so many different paths you can take. And when I came up, there was nothing, nothing like that at all. There was some books that were out of date as soon as they hit the shelves, and, and then the internet, right. And blogs and things like that. But, I found success the same way, was, doing things that like were either fun or like I wanted to fix. Right. And you were telling this story, when you were talking about the automated spreadsheet, the thing that, I was thinking in my head, it's like a curse and a blessing of people who learn program, like once you start down the path, like once you've figured out some stuff, is that you start seeing this everywhere, like, oh my god, that I could make this easier. Right. And it's like, and it's when you do it, it's like a blessing, right? But it's also, I have this, for me anyway, maybe this isn't for everybody, but it's like I start thinking about it all the time for everything. And sometimes it gets out of hand. Sometimes I'm automating things that don't actually take me that long. Probably it's probably the work is taking longer than the thing did, but I don't know. It's such a, once you get into that habit of thinking that way and like, and making things, it can improve your life. And like you said, you can improve little annoying things or, little things, like small things with your family or your friends, or large changes too. And it's cool. There's so many possibilities out there.
Man, are there any of the projects that you've done, Dan, that are particularly redundant or maybe like not the most effective use of time?
How many color lights can you see behind me?
Quite a few, actually.
Yeah. Becca knows. Every time we start, like, there was 2 months or something where so these are all like Hue light bulbs, and there's ones you can't see too. And I've spent so much time because I hated the lights in here. I had before these, I just had like lights, like lamps everywhere, and never could get the lighting right. And then I got these, you know, and so I have. Now I got these Hue. I'm like, this is the perfect solution. Hue bulbs, because you can connect. You know, you can connect them onto your phone or your. You know, there's probably a web or a Mac app and all that stuff. And so I replaced all the bulbs with these things. And now there's too many. Now it's like there's too much to do. Like I have too many options. There's too many colors. Too many like ways I could turn them up and down. And also I got it exactly how I wanted it. But then it was like, okay, well, it's still a pain for me to like open my phone. And like to push the button, you know, so like trying to get these like timing automations. I finally bought, oh, you can't see it, but I bought, so Hue has this like a button that you, it is just like a little click button, and you can put it on the wall or you can put it wherever. And you can set that to do whatever you want when you click it different ways. Cool. So I have that on my wall now. So I spent like 5 days of being happy. I'm like, ah, oh, this is it. I have it. And like, just this morning I sat down, I'm like, I should change the colors in these lights. These lights. So it's a sometimes struggle with being satisfied with things, but it's also fun though, you know.
Man, Becca, you have virtual coffee. I think it'd be totally fair to call that an amazing project that both of you have created. It's a community I love and love being part of. And so is it sort of the same sort of thing that has happened with you, Becca, where you've had these things that you've taken on and you've made and resulted in these learning experiences? And I'd imagine virtual coffee has been an amazing learning experience.
Oh, for sure. It's been a learning experience and it's been great. I feel like I'm always dropping things. We have the maintainers channel. And so you... There will be times where I just like drop a bunch of different ideas. Like these are all things that I think we should be doing. And a lot of times, like I'm writing out all of the processes or what this means or what support we need. And then obviously we don't do all of those because there's only 24 hours in a day and it's just not possible. And that was like, I got 4 hours of sleep last night. And it was because last night before bed, I was having this idea about a tech summit that I wanted to be doing. And I was like messaging Kirk and Nick Taylor about that, like, hey, is this an idea that's too out there? Or is this something that maybe is useful or good or worth like talking about? And then I fell asleep, and then it was like 3 a.m. I woke up and my brain was like, all right, yeah, let's figure this out right now. No. But I feel like, you know, it's a lot of that, but learning has been really great. And now I feel like I'm going down this. I don't like Notion. I've not liked it anytime I've used it, but like my methods of storing all of these ideas and writing about them is just unsatisfactory now. And so I've started going down the Notion rabbit hole of like, this is what I need to do. And I need to automate these things to my Notion because I know that I can. So I feel like you could probably automate like what your lights look like through Notion, right? If you just select what mood you're in and then it will automatically set your lights. So Dan, you should try that.
Yeah. Last time I messed with Notion, I had like a nervous breakdown trying to get everything exactly like,
Kirk is making me a template. So
yeah, that's the issue I have with Notion is it's a great product and it's very, very cool. And there's just too many possibilities and it's too, it's like possible to get it. It seems possible to get it perfect. And it's like when that like perfect thing gets in my head, it's sometimes hard to let it go. So
yeah, we've spent a lot of time in Notion too. It's things that are highly customizable are often not the best tools, right? Like it's, you know, I appreciate software that has opinion sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Becca.
Right now I've just collected way too many different ways of doing things. Like, you know, I've got all these apps to help me with planning or note-taking or, you know, whatever. There's just way too many of them. So I feel like I'm just very all or nothing kind of person. And so I can't have all of these. Now I just need one thing. And Notion is the one thing to rule them all, apparently.
And so, but, you know, in circling back, like, Becca, you have this awesome job. You're an amazing community manager. Did you have those skills before you started Virtual Coffee, or was that something that you learned and kind of just figured out going through the process?
When I was in undergrad, I graduated in 3 years, so I took a bunch of credits, but I was also in 10 clubs and I was an officer in like 5 of them. So I feel like it's been a lifelong journey of community building and many points where I've tried to reject that. Like, please let me just be in a hole by myself and not talk to people. But I keep coming back to it. I feel like I finally hit the point where I'm like, okay, like this is a skill set. I should utilize it and figure out how I can best do that thing. So yeah, it's I guess part of me.
That's really cool. I think that, like, one of the things that I was hard to figure out, and I'm okay, I'm kind of like left turning the conversation a little bit. One of the things that was really hard to figure out in running a business is, like, how do you hire? And you need to figure it all out from scratch, because, like, we'd hired a bunch of people at Microsoft IBM, but it was all a very catered experience. Like, we outsourced all of the hard upfront work, and we got these, like, just like 50 incredible candidates, and we would divide them up on our team and figure out who was going to do round one, round two, round three, right? And that, like, interviewing is easy, but hiring is hard, and hiring is all that other stuff. It's like finding people and evaluating them, and then, you know, you read about all the bad things that happen in the hiring process, and you don't want to do those, and you want to do the good things, and you want to get the right person and the right people. The thing that has always stand out to me is personal projects. And it's probably not surprising given the history I just described, right? Like, I value them a lot, but I think that when somebody comes in and they say, hey, I made this thing, and here's why I made it, and here's, like, how it's important, for, like, small business especially, that is so helpful, because it's like the person is thinking about a need on the other side of what they're doing. And, like, you know, it's, we don't have, like, tickets where we're working through, we're too small. We don't have a ton of process around things, but, like, when people come in, and I imagine this is the case for you, Becca, and you do this amazing community management and all this other stuff, and you have Virtual Coffee as this incredible example of you doing that in tech at scale. And I just, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what led to the job that I have right now. I wasn't looking for work. My team lead reached out to me, and it was based on Virtual Coffee, and somebody else had who I'd interviewed with, who had reached out to me last summer, because they knew about Virtual Coffee, recommended me. Like, I was on the top of their list. And so once he started looking into Virtual Coffee, I think he watched some of our Lunch and Learn videos and read blog posts. Like, there is a, my community building resume is out there because of all of the things that we do. And so, yeah, it is like a project. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but it is this living resume of all of the things that I've been working on.
Totally. And Dan, watch out, because, like, Phillips is going to come knocking and say, hey, I heard all these things you're doing with our light bulbs.
Yeah. Like, the CTO. They're going to come and say, hey, buy this product. This product will finally solve all of your problems.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I hope all our conversation in this podcast has an index, because we'll go to these Google searches and it's just going to be all Phillips Hue light bulbs. Right.
But we are open for sponsorships. So
yes, there we go.
That's right.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's that's really interesting. I think those personal projects, they really stand out. And and certainly there's merit if you're going to a boot camp and going through that. You want to stay on task, right? And if you're gonna get great learning and great feedback by building something that it, like, the boot camp is saying, oh, we're gonna build, like, a, you know, shopping cart, that's totally cool, right? But those other pieces of, like, hey, I've got this skill set now and I can use it to just really do anything I want, it's just so attractive to me in a hiring process. It really separates people out. And I'd imagine that's been the experience for both of you from what you've described too.
Yeah. And like, if your only projects coming out of a bootcamp are what you did in the bootcamp, and everybody else is trying to get a job too, you know, everybody is going to have the same set of projects. Right. And so that's another thing, is doing those. And
maybe there's not enough time to do it while you're in the boot camp, you know, maybe kind of do it after. But those personal projects, I totally agree with you, man. It says so much about you without even speaking. And then it also gives you something to talk about that's easy to talk about because you did it, and you know. So it's not a theoretical thing or a, you know, school assignment that you weren't connected with, you know. And again, it doesn't have to be world changing or a successful product or anything like that, right? You were talking about that Chrome extension that you made. That's literally just you and your wife, right? And that's it. And like, but that's a cool project. And I would like I enjoyed hearing about it. And I would, if I was hiring, I would also enjoy hearing about it. You know, you didn't like sell it to somebody or, you know, it doesn't have to be some, I don't know, huge thing. It's just a thing that you decided to do on your own and you figured out how to do it. And that's the cool part for me.
We just wrapped up a hackathon at DeepGram and one of our participants had, I think, 5 submissions, and this is a month-long hackathon. And the submissions were all interesting, and they were all beautiful. The design was really great. I'm really terrible at design, and the fact that all of these looked really wonderful, were meaningful and interesting projects was great. But I interviewed that participant for a blog post highlight, and being able to hear the stories behind it, to hear how he communicated what he did, his approach, how he did it. He's a person in the top of my book that I would recommend for a job. And I know that he's looking and he's going to be more actively looking soon. And so when anything comes up, I know that I'm going to reach out to that person. So, you know, if it doesn't catch the eye of somebody who's doing the hiring, it might catch the eye of somebody who's in a position where people reach out to them and say, hey, do you know anybody? Like, yes, I do. This person would be really, really great for this role.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, another sort of related thing that I hear a lot of hiring managers articulate, and there's famous examples of this too, is like a really strong indicator of success in a business is, or in a particular role is has that person achieved a success or excellence in a completely different area. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, Shopify has this famous example where their CEO gave an internship or a job to someone because they were like ranked in the top 50 at StarCraft, you know, and awesome. There's like similar sort of conversation and in sales, like, you know, this other sort of area around people who have had athletic success, you know, so there are people who are sales managers who are like, oh, you were a Division II athlete in track. Like, that's a really strong indicator for this other type of thing. And I think like you also see it in like volunteerism, like the stuff you did and we're describing in university, Becca, right? It's interesting, these signals, because the way that we typically interview is like in front of a whiteboard and we know it's a hard process to take on anyways, all I have to say.
Yeah, it is really hard. And I think even hearing a lot of conversations around hiring where people are trying to do things, there's still so much of the process where we're stuck inside this box. So rather than like really trying to rethink how we do the entire process, we're like, well, we're going to rethink, but we still have to do all of these things. And we have to ask these questions because you have to, you don't have to. That's not, what is that indicating? And how does that tell you whether or not that's going to be a good person for you to work with or a good team for you to join? How do we rethink the way that we're doing hiring, how we're onboarding new people, how we are looking at junior developers in this hiring process? I can't. And in my mind, it has to be, there's a much bigger shift that needs to happen than, you know, these tiny changes that we keep seeing happening.
Yeah, there's a part of me that, and I want to sort of say this in the best possible way, that I wish that people generally were more deliberate about what they wanted out of a job. And this has been something that's been incredibly important for me. And, you know, there's books that like sort of get you thinking on these topics. But like really early on for me was at that juncture where I'm like, oh, like a career in tech, and specifically there's a shift I had you know, a couple of years after learning code, where I very deliberately, I want to run a business. I want to run a technology-based business. And that wasn't for the sake of wanting to do that. It was because of these other things that I wanted. I literally had a moment where I sat down and I said, what do I want out of my work life? And, you know, for me, they were things that were connected to autonomy. I wanted, like, in a perfect world, I would work where and when I wanted to. I would, like, I was always confused that we had this like 40-hour a week box that we often live in. Like, why does that have to exist? You know, like, what are the reasons that the edges of that box are there? Yeah. And like, what if one week I want to work less and one week I wanted that type of control too? You know, there are these, I wanted to work on any type of problem that I wanted. I wanted to have the potential for financial independence, you know, these types of things. And that put, like, you know, to me, that was really helpful because it determined the types of jobs that I wanted to work at and why. And so when I started applying to, and I think I applied to, you know, and putting IBM and Microsoft aside because I never actually put an application into either company. Once you get in, I just won't go there, but it's a different process. And but I did apply to two technology companies to be a programmer. And my purpose in applying to them was, you know, the conventional wisdom that working at a startup will help you do a startup later. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to run my own business. So I was applying to a very particular type of company because the purpose of that learning was to help me do this thing later. And, you know, the funny thing about people who are junior developers and who are graduating like in 2022 is in a very short period of time, they're the hiring managers. And, you know, my gut feeling is that if people were approaching that process with like a very deliberate set of values and intentions, that hiring would change on the back end later. Or maybe not, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. And it can be really hard, especially with so many people looking for jobs on the market right now. And I know that I spend a lot of time telling people, when you join your first team, it should be about the people and not the project, because I've seen so many people jump into, particularly ed tech companies. I don't know if it's just generally ed tech that's really toxic or what, but just really bad experiences. And there's been the whole like mission trade-off thing. Well, you know, we've got a great mission. Well, but you're doing a terrible job of managing a team, being kind to other people, you know, like those things matter.
Yeah. You know, you talk about ed tech and I completely echo that sentiment. I think it's totally correct. Video game industry is notorious, right? For like, it's not being a great place to work. If there was one thing that I learned working in big tech, going from a college where you make this amount of money, you need a $1,500 raise a year and it's unionized and X and Y and Z. And then like, I remember the week that I joined IBM, they like flew me down to Silicon Valley for 2 weeks. We had this event and there was like this music. It was just all catered and it was all free. And it was crazy, the amount of money. And I got the opportunity to work with I loved both of those jobs. Loved, loved, loved both of them. And I think one of the things that I've learned is that a lot of the things that we want in an employer, a really, really strong indicator is the health of the business. If you want to work, you know, my wife works at Shopify. She loves it there. And, you know, Shopify makes so much money that they can hire people that all they do is think about diversity and equity. And they hire they have a whole team that all they do is think about culture. And they have whole teams that do nothing but, you know, run in internal events and try to make that a great place to work. You know, you can do that if you've got a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of diversity in tech, my AI team at Microsoft, we were extremely diverse by every standard. We had more women than men. And that's an AI where, like, it's AI and data science is enormously behind computer science. It's where computer science was like 15 years ago. But we were able to have a diverse team at Microsoft because we could outbid everybody. You know, we could go hire the best, and the best wanted to work for us. And we could afford it. And there's a million other examples like that. So it's like, I think going full circle, a lot of ed tech can be a really tough place to work because that's a really, really hard business to be in. and you're pinching every corner, and usually you are. And same with the video game industry, is it is like, you know, if that game does well, congratulations. But if it doesn't, like, it's really, it's a tough environment to work in. So, you know, if you want to have a really great place to work, I think the best, most simple indicator you can look at is like, how much money did they raise in the last round if it's a startup? If it's a publicly traded company, is it growing? Look at their stock chart for 5 years. Does it go up? You know, if it does, probably a great place to work. If it's flat, it you know, you might be getting, like, you might not have budget to go to that next conference. It's, you know, and similarly, people might not be attracted to work there in the same.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I want to thank you so much for being here with us today and having this conversation. There's a lot of really great takeaways, I feel like, from all the stuff that we talked about here. Is there anything that you want to share before we leave, or any last words of wisdom for our listeners?
No, thanks, everyone. Thank you, Becca and Dan, for having me. It's great. If nothing else, I think one of the things we all took away from today is build personal projects. Go make stuff. Like, you know, the old Ycom motto, make stuff people want, right?
Yeah.
Make stuff you want.
Yeah.
Share with us too. We want to see them.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks. This is awesome.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. This episode was produced by Dan Ott and Becca Harat-Weigel. If you have questions or comments, you can hit us up on Twitter at virtualcoffee.io or email us at podcast@virtualcoffee.io. You can find the show notes, sign up for the newsletter, check out any of our other resources on our website, virtualcoffee.io. If you're interested in sponsoring Virtual Coffee, you can find out more information on our website at virtualcoffee.io/sponsorship. Please subscribe to our podcast and be sure to leave us a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.